When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights!
History.
Win.
We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome to the Project Upland Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting. We plan to take you into some of our favorite bird covers as we talk to the people that hunt them and the organizations that support them. We'll also break down the dogs, guns, and gear used to pursue them, and of course, we'll share the stories that celebrate this American tradition.
It's one of those things that you do that feels timeless.
My dad brought home our first Brittany when I was about 10 years old.
The red gods are calling, and I must go.
These are your stories.
This is the Project Upland Podcast, presented by Onyx Hunt. I'm your host, Nick Larson. On this episode of the show, we talk New Jersey upland hunting with Joel Pankala of Griffin & Howe. Welcome to the show for episode number 86. Project Upland Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, creators of the most comprehensive digital mapping system for hunters. Use the promo code PUP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. Earlier this month, Onyx just announced a new partnership with Weather Underground, which, if you didn't know, Onyx has weather data right in their app, and they've now partnered with Weather Underground, which has increased the number of weather stations the app can pull data from tenfold. Another value add from Onyx, trying to make it your one-stop shop when you're mapping, navigating, planning, strategizing your hunt in the field or at home. Onyx Hunt is with you all the time. Check it out, onyxmaps.com. The Project Upland Podcast is also brought to you by our friends at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp. You haven't experienced grouse camp until you've experienced it at Pine Ridge. Find out more about the Pine Ridge Grouse Camp experience by visiting pineridgegrousecamp.com. And by Doctor Callers. For over 30 years, Doctor has collaborated with industry professionals to create class-leading tools for e-collar training, GPS tracking, and more to support bird dog owners in developing top-notch dogs. And they make really great collars. Check them out at dogtra.com. and by Yukonuba Premium Performance Dog Food. Out in the field, how you've prepared determines how you'll perform. With balanced fat and protein to support peak condition in your bird dog, Yukonuba Premium Performance Dog Food enhances strength, energy, and endurance, so when that tailgate finally drops, you and your dogs are ready for anything. Strong, focused, ready for anything, that is a Yukonuba dog. And by Gumleaf USA, high-quality, handcrafted, premium rubber boots that will stand the test of time. If you didn't have a pair of Gumleaf boots this year, well, you can always have one next year. Head over to GumleafUSA.com and use the promo code PUP10 to save 10% from Gumleaf USA. And by Gordian Sons Outfitters, when your boots have the proper tread, you never notice how slippery it is. When your hunting jacket features the right liner, your body temperature won't enter your mind. When your shooting vest allows total freedom of movement, you won't think twice about swinging through that quail. At Gordian Sons, they want you to focus solely on the hunt, not the performance of your gear. That's why the Gordy family has personally curated the best-in-class gear from around the globe for their store. Find out more about the gear, the guides, the expertise, everything they have to offer by visiting GordianSons.com. And by Dakota 283 Kennels. Kennels built to last a lifetime. One-piece, rotomold design, frame steel door, everything you and your dog need in a kennel for a safe and successful hunting trip. Find out more about them and get yours today by visiting Dakota283.com. All right, this week's winner of the podcast giveaway is Mike O. from right here in Minnesota. Mike nominated his friend Audie last week to win the podcast giveaway for taking Mike out hunting this year. Mike is an adult onset hunter. He's just got into upland bird hunting. He had a great season and he's been enjoying the podcast, and we appreciate his feedback. So Mike is this week's winner of the giveaway. Anybody listening could be next week's winner of the podcast giveaway. All you have to do is make a meaningful contribution to the show. Leave us a rating, leave us a review in the podcast app, subscribe to the podcast post, share the podcast, send us some feedback or guest suggestion. We'd like to hear from our listeners. You can email me at nick.larson@northwoodscollective.com. One quick announcement, Public Grouse. We talked about it last week. Get your tickets today via Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Public Grouse is hopefully coming to a city near you. We can't be everywhere, but we will be in at least 20 locations across the country. Head over to backcountryhuntersandanglers.com. Check out Public Grouse and get your tickets today. All right, we're jumping into today's interview with marketing manager at Griffin & Howe, Joel Pancala. Joel has written for Project Upland magazine. He was featured in a recent Project Upland film, Legacy. He works as marketing manager for Griffin & Howe, buying, selling, and shooting a lot of different shotguns. He has a lot to offer. We talk New Jersey upland hunting. We later get into traveling wing shooting, and we round it out with a little bit of shotgun conversation. I hope you enjoy this one, and I'd like to wish everybody listening a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Project Upland podcast marketing manager at Griffin & Howe, Joel Pancala. All right, Joel, here we go. Welcome to the Project Upland podcast. How are you, man?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And I'm going to do a little last second show preparation here. Joel, how do you pronounce your last name?
Pancala.
Now, I know, and all the listeners of the Project Upland podcast know, so pro podcasting tip, always do that before you hit record, but we're doing it on the fly today, so no worries.
All good.
All right, man. It is December 19th. Appreciate you taking some time to chat with us when the world kind of seems to slow down a little bit. You know, we're looking ahead at holidays coming up next week, and I know for me, I've been very busy at work because obviously I have got a busy fall traveling and stuff. And now I'm kind of playing catch up and doing a lot of that kind of stuff. How have things been going for you? You've been out in the woods. Have you been in the field? You've been working like a dog so you can slow down for the holidays. What have you been up to?
Well, quite a bit of all those things, actually. So it's been a busy fall. I have done a good amount of local bird hunting and out with the setters and chasing the woodcock around in New Jersey. I was actually out in Alaska for a couple of weeks. A good friend of mine pulled a doll sheep tag, so I took some time off to get up there and spend some time in the mountains, which was an experience to be sure. And at this point, right before the holidays for us, we're just getting ready for all of our shows. So we're going to roll into show season in January, February, and March, and we'll be out there at be in Dallas for Safari Club and down at Seawee. We're going to actually be at the National Wild Turkey Show down in Nashville this year, and also out to the Easter Sheep Show. So we're trying to get all our ducks in a row and make sure that we're prepared for our, for us, this is our big show season. So it's, you know, it slows down a little bit in terms of the repair side of things, but for sure we're busy behind the scenes.
So big trip to Alaska, not a trip that doesn't sound like you had the opportunity to carry a shotgun. Did you see any ptarmigan or any birds?
Well, we did. Being a consummate bird hunter, I couldn't go into the woods without a shotgun. So we actually did get the opportunity to shoot some ptarmigan.
All right.
When we were up there, and I added one to the life list. So that was a kind of a requirement, I suppose, for going to the bush in Alaska. You know, I like to check birds off my, you know, North American Grand Slam whenever I have the opportunity, and I don't get many opportunities to go to Alaska. So shotgun was on my backpack, and so we had a full complement. Actually, we had a high power rifle for sheep, we had 22 for small game, and a shotgun for birds. So we were prepared for whatever was going to come our way, and we actually did spend a little bit of time fishing as well, and caught some grayling, and it was a full Alaska experience up there. I can't speak highly enough about if you ever have the opportunity to go to Alaska. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I went there when I was a senior in high school. I went on a fishing trip. I was there in June, and I was in Sitka, so way down the coast. But so I got kind of a little slice of it, but I have not been really on the mainland or anything like that and experienced what you had. It sounds interesting. That's cool that you did get to put a little ptarmigan in the bag for some camp meat, I suppose.
Yeah, we ate ptarmigan pretty well, and some fish as well to keep us going when we were in the backcountry. So it was definitely a once in a lifetime experience.
So you mentioned travel. Go ahead.
So for a guy who primarily chases upland birds, a big game hunt was something completely out of my wheelhouse, but certainly a welcome change.
Well, that's interesting because I didn't think to ask you that question, but I certainly know you as an upland bird hunter because we met under those pretenses at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp a couple of falls ago. But a logical question would have been, do you do much big game hunting? Because I remember talking to you about some of your customers and the outfitting that you guys do at Griffin and Howe, which we can touch on a little bit, but it sounds like not a whole lot of big game hunting.
Yeah, so I grew up obviously as a bird hunter in New Jersey. We really don't have a major complement of big game. We've got big three. You know, we're talking for us, it's whitetail, deer, black bears, and wild turkeys is quote unquote our big game. So it's kind of odd for an East Coast boy for his first big game hunt to be doll sheep in Alaska. But you know, one of my sayings is, if you're going to do something, you might as well go big.
And yeah, you went big.
So that was officially my first big game hunt that I actually backpacked in for and all the rest. So
okay.
I had, you know, I'm familiar with backpacking, have done backpacking trips, and actually I had done the same guy, Chris, that I went to Alaska with. We went to Nevada and chased snowcock together several years ago. So we had done a backcountry backpacking hunting trip already.
Okay.
But again, under slightly different context.
Yeah, you guys have some pretty big black bears there in New Jersey.
We do. Yeah, we have a very healthy population of black bears, quite a few.
Now, we're way off track here, but that's okay. That's ringing a bell for me. There was something in the news like this fall or over the summer about New Jersey black bear hunting. Did they cancel hunting, or did they want to, or what was going on there? Do you recall that?
So it does tie in, and I'll kind of bring it back around.
Perfect. You be the host and you segue us, Joel.
Yeah, I'll try to do the best segue I can right here. So black bears in New Jersey, for a long time were a game species, and they almost completely eradicated them from the state. And then at one point in time, they became, what we call a non-game species here, along with, the mourning dove. So, it kind of ties it together. Both black bears and mourning doves are not mandated by the Fish and Game Council. So because they're non-game species, the governor and the politics of the state actually, the governance actually controls the seasons on them, which is why the governor can, which is what he did. He canceled, in the past, the black bear hunt has been canceled because of basically politics. But our current governor restricted hunting to private ground, and basically any public held ground owned by the state of New Jersey was closed.
Okay.
So all of our wildlife management areas, all of our state parks were closed, but the federal grounds and the private grounds were still open to bear hunt. So it's kind of a controversial issue here. We have more than enough bears to go around. We certainly don't put a dent in the population. They extend the season every year because they never meet their quota. So the state has a quota set for a harvest number and they never actually meet it. So they always end up extending the season. But the reason this all ties in is because of the recent season closure this year, and it made news quite a bit, and I wrote about it a little bit, was the article that I wrote about New Jersey grouse hunting, and there was an emergency closure of the season, of the rough grouse season. And the toughest part about that is that, again, now that rough grouse is going to fall kind of into that group of species like doves and bears, that it's not just going to be, oh, the grouse are back and we can reopen the season. There's going to be a lot more red tape and paperwork to go through to get them back, basically back on and back on as a species that we can hunt.
Gotcha. And that is an excellent segue. We'd be remiss if we did not talk about that development in New Jersey, rough grouse hunting and the cancellation. And I actually was pretty well aware of that just in some communication with the Rough Grouse Society. And I saw your article on the blog. So that's a good topic of conversation. That brings to mind a couple of questions. Now, are there, with your knowledge of New Jersey hunting and politics and the landscape, you know, however deep it goes, are there concerns about when the rough grouse or any wildlife species goes into that non-game category? Is there concern over loss of funding for conservation and habitat? I mean, I don't know how all the funding mechanisms or anything work, but does it become a slippery slope? That's where my mind is going, but I'm not sure if you can comment on that at all.
It's a difficult thing. I mean, densely populated state, New Jersey is extremely densely populated,
right.
And we have, over the course of time, slipped into a place where we are dealing more with human-wildlife interaction and have a lot more sociopolitical things at play that affect wildlife much more so than funding or you know, the politics behind it. So essentially what that means is that it's really a matter of the politics and the parties that are at play for habitat, for wildlife, for conservation than it is for anything else. So we certainly have monies in the state, although, you know, again, most people think of New Jersey as the Parkway and the Jersey Shore. There's quite a bit of the state, both north and south, that's open space. And we have a lot of designated open space in the state that could be managed for wildlife. But again, the primary reasons that, at least from my perspective, that I see that they're not more actively managed is this idea that the wild spaces either aren't important or that they don't deserve the attention that they do. And that's part of why we've had the decline that we have in early successional habitat, and as a result, decline in grouse and woodcock and other species that utilize that cover. Where, in contrast, a lot of the species that benefit from older growth forest or kind of the steady march of time and of human influence, you know, our deer, our bear, our turkeys are doing just fine. Because they can flourish in that kind of environment where you have larger timber and interspersed houses, you know, they're doing just fine.
Right. Yep. Two species that are very well adapted to kind of that, you know, urban woodland type environment. While we're on the topic of New Jersey, I mean, I will link to the article that you wrote and had been recently published on the Rough Grouse Society blog. Another piece of writing that you did was in the, I believe it was the fall issue of Project Upland magazine. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And that kind of talked about your history and upbringing as a wing shooter. Really enjoyed that article. And don't tell AJ, but I just read that this morning. I'm way behind on my reading. I got a stack of magazines. I'm sure he'll listen to this at some point and hopefully he doesn't get too mad at me, but it was an excellent article. And it was almost coincidence that I read it this morning. You know, I knew that we had the interview set up tonight, but I didn't read that article this morning on purpose. I just happened to be getting through my stack of magazines. Excellent article. And, you know, that painted kind of a neat picture for me as somebody that I'm not very familiar with New Jersey, the East Coast. I've never hunted out there. I've spent limited time out there. And I would have been that person to just sort of paint a broad stroke and think, oh, well, New Jersey's got to be just one big city. You know, that's what it is. That's what the East Coast is, right? You know, I just haven't spent enough time out there to see those open spaces and the public lands that you guys have access to. So the article that you did on Rough Grouse Society and the article that you wrote in the Project Upland magazine painted actually a cool picture of
an opportunity that you had to grow up a wing shooter in New Jersey. Now, I know that things are definitely not as rosy as they once were, and I feel like you kind of laid that out nicely. Could you talk a little bit, without diving too deep into it, could you talk a little bit about sort of that story arc of wing shooting and upland hunting in New Jersey that you kind of know, you know the story from your dad, and then now what you've seen in the past, you know, 30 years or so?
Yes. So my dad's worked as a biologist for the state for a long time, and he went to actually Rutgers University as a biologist and came out of college and worked in the state, lived in the southern part of the state. But we're talking back in the 70s when, you know, there was still a lot of transitional cover. And honestly, the hunting back then was, you know, everybody talks about the good old days. And, you know, when I talked to him, he talked about living down there and the opportunities that there were for somebody who was a bird hunter. At one point in time, there were four different species of wild game bird in the state. We had bobwhite quail, we had wild pheasants, rough grouse, and woodcock. And the idea that you could hunt four different wild species of game in the state of New Jersey all in one day, for the upland hunter, that was a pretty romantic vision of the past. And you know, so he brought that with him when he moved to the northern part of the state, and that's where I grew up. I grew up in northwest New Jersey, in Sussex County. And it just so happens that my portion of the state borders the Delaware River. And again, back in the 70s, there was a movement to, the government actually wanted to dam the Delaware River and create a large reservoir to serve as a water source for New York City. Fast forward a few years and a few protests later, they had taken over all the property, and then essentially the project got stopped. So there was enough public outcry that they stopped this Tox Island Dam project, and were stuck with this huge tract property that they couldn't give back. They were now owners of it. It actually became the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area. So that was all, essentially it was all farms. And in my youth, so I'm 35, almost 36 now, but in my youth, when I started hunting at 10, 12, 14 years of age, much of that ground was still in its successional progression. So I got to grow up hunting grouse and woodcock in a part of the state that was improper for its time. It didn't really fit. It was an unreal kind of vision of what proper wildlife management could be.
Sure.
By having all this early successional habitat. And I was able to actually be there in what I would consider my, you know, that was the golden days. As a kid, I can remember hunting with my father, you know, stealing moments here or there, being able to drive 20 minutes to a cover, hunt for a little while and kill grouse and woodcock over our dogs. And we had, you know, a variety of dogs. We, you know, setters, Brittany's over the years. And I just, again, as a young child, it was ingrained in me that this was just something that we could do. We could run out after work. We could run out after school. We were there every Saturday and chase the birds that we loved. And not the least of which aided that was the fact that New Jersey still has, and to this day, still has a pretty good put and take pheasant stocking program. So the state of New Jersey, right now we're in the, we purchase pheasants from Pennsylvania, from the state of Pennsylvania, not from the state itself, but from a private party there. And New Jersey still stocks, from my understanding, 35 to 45,000 pheasants on the wildlife management areas in the state. So coming from a state that most people view as kind of, like I said, one big city, there was a lot of opportunities for a young man who, you know, got introduced to it at a young age and grew up chasing those birds around. It was great. We could transition right from the migration of the woodcock in October into the pheasant stocking in November, December, and they ran it right through to New Year's. So for several months of the year, my focus was almost laser on just being out in the woods and chasing birds around.
That's a very cool and unique, obviously, that you got to experience, I guess you could call it a man-made, you know, golden years in rough grouse hunting in New Jersey because of that project. And that project, you know, it was a significant event that you knew about, but I think it's interesting that you actually have the perspective and you can recognize that bubble in grouse population. That's kind of what I was getting at, like sort of an artificial bubble in the population because of macro changes on the landscape. You recognize that, you know, I think that's kind of uncommon. I think a lot of people have maybe a fuzzy memory in their head of when the best hunting was, but to actually acknowledge and pay attention to what factors were at play. And was that bubble, was it natural or was it artificial? And what were the things influencing? I just think that's kind of interesting to look at, no matter what population or species you're looking at.
Well, I think the other thing that it really serves, at least from my point of view, it's a very clarifying and crystallizing vision of what management can actually achieve.
For sure.
So we had a lot of open space and the government made a big move. And perhaps that move, you know, from a lot of viewpoints, that move was looked down upon and eventually struck down by the people. We said, hey, look, we don't want to do this. The Delaware River is one of the last free-flowing rivers on the East Coast, if not the last. That's an undammed river on the East Coast. People spoke out about it, and it was a terrible time. People got evicted and kicked out of their houses, and it was very tumultuous in the time. But the end result of that was this great experiment, right? So we had this experiment to see what wildlife management could produce. So intensively for many years, you had this beautiful change of habitat and the structure of the environment changed, and with it came this wonderful opportunity. So as much bad as there was, there's equal good. And again, from my point of view, I look at it as an example of what we can do given the opportunity. So there's no reason why grouse can't be back in the state of New Jersey. Given the opportunity, we can make the habitat to make it so. It's the public, at least from my point of view, it's the public perception and the voices to speak out about it, to tell people, you know, why it's good to actually have some changes in habitat, some early successional habitat, why it's good to cut down some trees. And, you know, that's, to me at least, that's why New Jersey's gone the way it has, is that there's been a lack of awareness and lack of support for active wildlife management.
Yeah, that's phenomenal perspective. That's a cool way to look at it. And that's where I wanted to go next. I think people can kind of gather from picking it up from listening to the conversation, but let's fast forward to the fall of 2018, when you still had a rough grouse season. That area was an area that you had hunted. I don't know. Do you still live in that area now, or are you not near there?
Yeah, no, I actually moved closer.
Okay.
I grew up about 25 minutes away from where I live now. And I purchased a property that actually touches the same area I'm talking about, the National Recreation Area. My property actually borders it. So I'm one of the lucky few that can walk out my back door and go hunting.
That's very cool. That's awesome. That's actually a dream / goal of mine someday. I want to be able to do that. So that's very cool. But, you know, even aside from that particular place, but you saw an area move through an early successional stage and you had great hunting. Now, again, people are gathering from the story that essentially that early successional forest grew, matured, aged, as most people that pursue rough grouse and woodcock, they're very familiar with sort of the age and life cycle of a forest, but that aged out and you're just not seeing the timber harvest, the active forest management out there today to maintain that. The grouse population has dwindled to a point where the season is now canceled. But what did a 2018 rough grouse hunt in New Jersey look like? Were you flushing 5 birds a day, 10 birds a day, 1 bird a day? What did it look like?
Oh, 1 bird a day would have been a joyous occasion.
Okay.
I mean, I say that in terms of the level of grouse in the state. There were very few of us that actually actively pursued them last year. And I did harvest grouse in the state of New Jersey last year. And my last hunt was one for the books, because I've hunted many days and not flushed a single grouse. And the last hunt that I had of the last day of the season was open. It was several days after it was actually a week, I think, after the small game season opened. The pheasant season was open, and it was one of the last days of the grouse season, but we actually had an early snow. And I took one of my setters out. I took my female setter out. She tends to work a little closer. And I actually ran her with no bell that day, which I normally run with a bell, and I went no bell that day because I wanted to be as quiet as possible. And we worked a cover that I had found only a few years before and walked through a good long ways, probably at least an hour of walking, and looped around the backside of a pond and was coming up through the thickest of the thickest stuff that there possibly was. And there's some white pines there. And again, snow on the ground. and a grouse. The dog gets a little bit birdie, and a grouse flushes out of some bittersweet vines tangled in a cedar tree. And the bird was up in the tree, and it flushed out and butt-hooked around, out too far ahead of me initially for a shot, but for whatever reason, banked to the left, and I can still see it in my mind. I missed the easy shot with the first barrel on my side-by-side and took a long poke through white pine tree with the second barrel, and I just saw that. I mean, if you're a grouse hunter, you know it. You see that flutter slash drop of a bird.
Yep.
And my heart leapt. I mean, I hadn't killed a bird in New Jersey in years. And I literally ran over to find the bird. And I had broken the right wing. I picture in my mind. I mean, I could see it like it was right now. I broke the outside of the right wing and I picked up the bird and broke the gun down, set it on the ground, put the bird down, knelt down on the ground and made a phone call with my father. I mean, it was the first thing I did.
Wow.
And I said, "You'll never believe what just happened." You know, because I said, "You'll never believe what just happened. I actually killed a grouse." And it was a red phase. Red phase female was that bird. And I mean, like I said, it was significant enough that I killed a grouse that I actually called someone
to notice
a single harvest. So for those of you who have the opportunity to harvest a lot of grouse, you know, keep that in mind that it can come to a point where a single bird warrants a phone call. And I actually, so at that point in time, they had reduced the limit to two birds. And I carefully tucked this bird into my bag and continued along my way. So earlier in the walk, I had actually flushed a single woodcock in a little piece of cover along some ground where there was a spruce heap. And I had killed a woodcock. So I had a woodcock and a grouse in my bag. And I'm working the edge of this field back to my truck. And the second bird, I can't even tell you, the second bird was in the same exact scenario as the first bird, but a far more difficult going away shot. But the dog actually gave me a flash point this time. So she knew the bird was there. She was looking up in the trees and she gave me just enough notice that I was able to get a shot off as a bird winged down a dropping shot out of a cedar, dropped and wung off over the field. And I took a shot at the bird and I just had a gut feeling that I had hit it, but I couldn't find it. There was no feathers, no blood, no nothing in the snow, and I couldn't even find where it had splashed down. And as I'm walking back and forth, searching, the dog kind of wanders out into this autumn olive patch of brush. She's not, you know, Belle, I love her to death. My female dog's name is Belle, and she's a wonderful dog, but she's not really a great retriever. She kind of disappears off into the cover, and I'm not paying attention because I'm so worked up that I've actually flushed a second grouse and had a shot that I then missed. You know, in my mind, I'm going, "Oh my God, I missed this bird." And she comes back with a grouse in her mouth.
Unreal.
So the last day of grouse hunting that I had on the last year of the season, I managed to pull off the impossible and find and harvest two grouse. And actually the second bird was a mixed phase, like a gray with some, like a gray phase with
reddish colors tones in it. Yeah.
Oh, and I just, again, you know, phone calls right away, you know, and then as if that wasn't enough, I knew where some spring seeps were and I managed to limit out on woodcock on my way out of the woods.
Wow.
So that's a story that, and an experience that I don't think I'll ever repeat. I mean, there's a time when you realize that you've hit your culmination. There's a time where the bird, you know, the birds work, the dog is on point and everything works out perfectly and your shooting is what it's supposed to be. And I can't say I've ever had a day that was like that. And I certainly don't expect to have another one.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that will be one that you will remember for some good reasons because of the obvious surface reasons of it was just a great grouse hunt, but then also some bad reasons in that, I mean, I hope it's not, but that could be your last New Jersey rough grouse hunt ever.
Yeah, it's tough. It's a thought to wrestle with, but I mentioned it in the article, but you know, there's many hunters that came before me that wrestled with the same thing. I mean, New Jersey used to have wild pheasants and wild quail and we don't anymore. I mean, there's just really no two ways about it. We don't have wild pheasants anymore. We don't have wild quail anymore. And the reality is, the truth of the matter is that, you know, especially for the generation before me, my father's generation, to watch, you know, now he's had three different wild game birds essentially be removed from the, you know, removed from his ability to hunt them. So I think it's pretty significant that in one man's, you know, my father's span of being a hunter in the state of New Jersey, that so far he's watched two species go away and now a third in terms of his ability to go pursue them. Essentially, for the upland hunter in the state of New Jersey, you're left with woodcock in terms of wild birds. And the fact that one man could watch three of four potential game species essentially vanish from the landscape is something extremely significant. And I don't think it's, you know, and I go back to it, but it's a ghost of, you know, upland seasons to come. It's not just going to be New Jersey. I mean, we are on the fringe, and there's no doubt about that we are on the fringe. But if something's not done, people are going to see this start to happen in other places. And I just hope that we can all kind of learn from the experiences that we've had here and hopefully make some changes before it's too late. Because I think in a lot of ways, New Jersey, I hate that I even am saying this, but I feel like in some ways, New Jersey is the lost cause. I don't know if there's enough backing and enough people who would be interested. It would take a major change in the way habitat is managed and the way things are done here to actually affect a positive change in rough grouse and woodcock numbers.
Right.
So I hold out hope. I still am very hopeful that we can somehow figure out how to wrestle this beast and make something of it. But again, I just, from the writing on the wall, from the past, you know, from looking at pheasants and quail, there's good research being done on quail in South Jersey right now, and they're trying to figure out why the numbers are declining. But it always goes back to habitat. I mean, that's the biggest thing is habitat.
Yeah, that's really the scariest part, man. I was going to make the comment that, you know, you mentioned it earlier, you're 35 years old, you're not that old, and you're seeing rough grouse, you know, the season close and the population dwindling to the point where they're not huntable. But then you mentioned your dad who's going to see three species basically go that way. I mean, that's, man, how much more of a wake up call do you need? And I guess we're usually talking to ourselves. We're talking to upland hunters. I mean, we get it for the most part, but it's unfortunately, there are too many other folks that are not interested, don't care, or are just working against us. And, you know, we have to watch this stuff happen. I mean, it's a buzzkill.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't feel good. And I think that I can echo that comment that you said about just the people that aren't aware or people who just don't care. And it's a sad state of affairs that wildlife can be disappearing. I mean, not just the fact that, yes, these are game birds and yes, there's this idea of pursuing them as a sport and as a hobby, but they're also gone from the landscape for everyone who enjoyed them for every other reason that you enjoy having wildlife around. You know, you see wildlife at your bird feeders or when you drive to work in the morning. And the sad state of affairs is that I don't want to only see deer, bear, and turkeys. I would love to see a diverse population of wildlife when I go out and ride around my hometown. And I just hope that perhaps there are some other folks out there that feel the same way.
Well, and you know what? That's a great point that you bring up, Joel, because that might indeed be the silver bullet in that the kinds of habitat and the kinds of forests that we're talking about don't just benefit the birds that you and I love. They benefit a whole suite of species that have made their living here and evolved here. And, you know, there was a report, I'm pretty sure it was Audubon. They came out with a report this fall that talked about is like 2.9 or essentially 3 billion birds being lost over the past. I don't remember the time frame, but if anybody looks up 3 billion birds lost, they'll probably find this Audubon report. And they're talking about just bird loss due to essentially habitat loss and changes in the environment. And, you know, again, if something's going to save the birds that you and I love and unite enough people to make a difference, it might be research like that to, you know, show people that, you know, it's not just one particular species. It's all wildlife that needs early successional forests or needs a diverse mix of forests to survive.
Yeah. I hope it starts as a wake up call. I know that that article circulated and I read it and saw it. And the truth is that's the kind of PR that you need. I mean, people need to understand that it's not just because it's coming from hunters who are in essence conservationists. It's not just coming from us. It's this outcry that, you know, there's not a lot of advocates for some of these, for some songbirds, you know, for goldwing warblers. The Audubon Society has done a great job with it, but, you know, the general layperson on the street has very little care about that. And the reality is that if we can paint this picture and say, look, it's not just these few species that we pick as the figureheads, this is across the board. This isn't something that's limited to rough grouse because I want to go hunt rough grouse.
Exactly.
You know, it's a picture to be painted for everything that we're looking at. And I think that's the bigger thing that we, the bigger message that we need to put out there is, hey, this is not just an issue for game species. This is going to become an issue for all species.
Yeah. As hunters, we're always going to be somewhat pigeonholed in that respect, because somebody that is perhaps a non-hunter or maybe even an anti-hunter, they're going to look at, you know, we're talking about, again, and maybe it's, you know, we've almost shot ourselves in the foot by touting these specific species. You know, it would be easy for somebody to perceive that we want more of these birds so we can shoot more of them, you know, when you and I know there's a whole lot more that goes into our thought process and why we want to see these birds thrive and flourish. At the surface level, to a passerby, you almost can't even blame them to, you know, for arriving at that conclusion, even though there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's inherent. We are resource users.
Yep.
So we're out there in and around it more often than not. And I, you know, a great example from a hunt the other day, I was out and I saw a ruby crown kinglet for the first time in a long time. And it's a very small songbird, gray, mostly gray, very drab. They have a kind of a little eye line that's got some good color on it. But just, I haven't seen as many of them as I've seen in past seasons. And I mean, I can remember as a kid seeing them all the time when I was out grouse and woodcock hunting, because they love, in our area, they love silky dogwood and the early successional habitat. And they were always in and around there. And I love them because these little songbirds were very brazen. They were not timid at all. So you'd be pushing through some cover and all of a sudden there'd be this little bird kind of hanging out. And I actually noted it in my mind. Hey, that's the first time I've seen the kinglet in a long time. I wonder if that's part of this whole conversation is, hey, those guys are going too. And it's, again, not just the grouse and the woodcock. It's all these other species that utilize this habitat. So being the front end of it, being on the forefront of it, I think it also makes our voice, you know, although maybe people view us as being skewed, we're also much more in it. We're more potent. We understand it. We see it firsthand.
Sure. Yeah. And we are invested, you know, and that investment is built on a lot of times passion and money and resources. And we put a lot into it and we get, I would say, you know, we often get a lot back. You know, we definitely get our money's worth as far as what the natural world and hunting and stuff gives back to us, but we certainly put a lot into it as well.
Sure.
That's a lot about New Jersey and birds and habitat. I think we'll transition a little bit and talk. I want to talk dogs, actually, because you mentioned your English setters, and I know you didn't have your English setters when we were out at Pine Ridge a couple falls ago, but we talked about dogs, and I think I saw and read about a Brittany in your article in the Project Upland magazine. Talk about your evolution with bird dogs, maybe what your dad used to run and how you wound up with your English setters today.
Yeah. So the first dog that my dad ever ran was the Beagle, which there's been many, many stories about the Beagles of Aspenpink, and that's a whole different podcast. But the first dog that I remember was a black lab. My dad had a black lab, and I was very, very young. Actually, one of my sole memories of that dog was holding onto the leash and the dog just taking off at full speed in the yard and getting smashed as a kid holding onto the leash. Yeah, so that's my one real memory of that dog. But my dad actually, he ran setters as well. So one of the first bird dogs that I can remember was a dog named Roxy. She was a setter that we had, a little smaller female setter. And then after Roxy, it went to, we had a dog named Jake. It was one of our best setters, English setters that we had. And we had a Brittany along the way. Her name was Ginger, a fantastic, fantastic little bird dog. I remember she was so bird crazy. I mean, she was a lover, don't get me wrong, but she was so bird crazy when you're out in the field that she would point a woodcock, you would flush it, shoot it, she would run and find it and retrieve it to you, and she would spit it out and just be back looking for the next bird. She wouldn't even wait for you to congratulate her or pet her. She literally spit it from a ways away at your feet and turned back around to go find the next bird. So
you can't teach that.
Yeah, she was just a great little dog. And then after that, it was just all setters. And I can't say why particularly my dad favored setters, but I think that for my own piece of this picture, I read enough stories and I looked at enough paintings, and I like setters. They're beautiful dogs. They run through the woods in a certain way. And for the cover that we hunted in the East Coast in New Jersey, we hunted very thick, dense cover. The setters that we had were very slow working dogs. They tend to stay very close. We always kept our dogs essentially within eyesight, if not earsight, so that they were very close to us. And the nature of the grouse where we are, even when we did have some grouse numbers, the grouse were very, very jumpy. We had almost never had a grouse hold to a point. So again, in the nature of the hunting that we did, the setters that we had actually worked very well for us.
Sure.
And for a lot of applications, that might not be the best kind of dog to run. But as a result, now I myself am a fan of setters. So I currently have three English setters. He's a 12-year-old male, Doc. I've got a 7-year-old female, Belle, and I've got their son, Nuge, who's three and a half years old right now.
Okay.
And I love my setters. I mean, I obviously have three of them and have run them quite a bit. And there's just something about a setter that, for me anyway, tickles my fancy.
Yeah. Do your dogs, do they hunt in a similar fashion as the dogs that you spoke about that growing up hunting with, closer working, slower working, kind of the same style of dog, or has that changed at all?
No, I mean, for the most part, they're close working dogs. The older male, I've been out west a few times, and the older male tended to range out more. So especially when we got into some flat ground and some prairie, he was not shy of getting 100, 150 yards away. He would, you know, stretch his legs. The female, on the other hand, never really had that kind of big running instinct. And I think the male that I have now, that's their son, is kind of somewhere in between. But the bird drive is there in him, which I really appreciate. So he has the lovability of my female and the bird drive of my male. But it's kind of a nice combination to actually have a dog who wants to hunt with you, but at the same time has that energy and that bird drive that really makes a fantastic bird dog. So, yeah, they're very much very similar to the dogs I'm used to hunting over. And I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I had some early influencers as well. So I grew up hunting with my father and his friends, and my father's hunting companions also ran English setters. And one of my father's companions, actually, he was a member of the Amwell Club in central New Jersey. And Amwell is one of those clubs that's kind of steeped in legend in this part of the state. And, you know, it's written about in some of the major books and things. But again, setters were part of that legend and that lore, and they were written about, and they were just very classic. It's the same reason that you own an old double gun that breaks all the time and doesn't go off when you pull the trigger. You know, it's part of the history and the mystique.
Right. Yep. We all have our reasons for winding up with a certain breed of dog, kind of shotgun, pair of boots, upland vest. Yep. You know, there's many reasons, and we all sort of develop our own little ecosystem and upland world. So that's kind of the beauty of it. And that's why we get so much enjoyment in talking to other people and learning how they arrived at their decisions and how they put their upland hunting lifestyle together, you know?
Of course.
Another thing you mentioned in the Project Upland magazine, we talked a fair bit about hunting in New Jersey, but you have taken some trips with your father, and you've done some trips to some Western states, hunted maybe the Dakotas and the Lake States. Talk a little bit about some of those experiences, maybe a favorite trip.
Oh, well, if I had to pick the favorite trip, it would certainly be the trip that my father and I took after I graduated from college. But I guess I have to kind of set the stage, because my father started taking me out of school when I was in high school, and we would go together and travel somewhere for a week or 2 weeks in the fall. And it was a very odd thing for all my teachers to understand, but a note would come in from my father saying, "I'm taking him out. Please give me all of his schoolwork and we'll see you in a couple of weeks." And those trips range from, you know, we went to Maine, we went to Michigan, went to Wisconsin and Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Wyoming, Montana. So we kind of hit quite a few different states, focused mainly on grass and woodcock. But then when we got out west, we took, going back to the trip that I would have to say was like the trip. When I graduated college, it took a little time off, and that subsequent fall, so I had a job for the summer, and the subsequent fall, my father and I had actually been planning it for quite some time. We took a road trip. We had a 24-foot camper, and we took a road trip and planned 2 months of bird hunting out west. And we took, actually, Nellie was one of my dad's female dogs, and Jake, which he was a male setter, and he was the old dog at that time, and he probably was one of the best dogs, best setters I've ever hunted over. And we were out there for essentially 2 months.
Wow.
And we started in Montana. We hunted Montana, Wyoming, and Nebraska, and just lived the life for 2 months. So get up in the morning and decide we're going to go chase birds and bring the dogs back, stake them out, eat some game food. I mean, that was the trip. And we happened to hit it when the bird numbers were up out west. So we actually went out on a great year, and we started in the very northern part of Montana with sharptails and huns, and shot sage grouse, shot wild pheasants, and then went into Wyoming, and all along the way, duck hunting, bird hunting. I mean, we just kind of trout fish. We did a little bit of everything. And that was by far my favorite trip. That was a phenomenal time for an impressionable lad of 22 years old. You can't, there's no way to trade for that experience. There's nothing. I would give just about anything to do that again.
I couldn't imagine. That sounds like an amazing trip. I mean, not to mention doing a whole bunch of stuff, you know, at one time, but the length of the trip, 2 months, and just really actually taking some time to soak it in.
Yeah. Yeah. The best remarks were, when we returned home, my mother was remarking about how thin everybody looked, including the dogs.
I bet.
You know, months on the road, you get back and, you know, skin and bones. So it was great. I mean, that's just it. I think that's the uplander's dream, is to chase the season from north to south. And I actually just had a conversation with my father about this tonight. Part of what makes upland hunting is that it's different than most everything else. Most all upland birds are created equal. So when you shoot, you know, when you shoot a pheasant, it's a pheasant. There's not a Boone and Crockett score. There's not a length. There's not a poundage to it. Every one is a trophy. And I think that in and of itself sets upland hunting apart, in that, at least for me anyway, and for my father, and I'm sure that's where it came from, is that the beauty of it and the thing that makes it special is that you can go to different landscapes and apply your knowledge and apply your skills and be successful, whether you're in Maine or Michigan or Montana. It doesn't matter where you are. You can apply those same skill sets and have a great experience in a totally different backdrop with a totally different bird.
That's a beautiful way to look at it, man. I couldn't agree more. I think the lack of individual birds being trophies, and the statement that, you know, all birds are trophies, I think that plays into upland hunting a lot, more so than I think we even talk about it and you hear about or read about. I know it's been talked about before, but I think it almost draws a certain kind of person into upland hunting. And that may be one of the reasons why upland hunters tend to find, I mean, I feel like we tend to make pretty easy friends. You find that connection with somebody and you make friends pretty quickly. And I think that's very common throughout upland hunting. And I think that has a lot to do with it.
I think there's, at least in my way of thinking, there's less adversarial thought towards it. And I'm not trying to best you on, you know, the score of my deer's antlers. Right. You know, we're out there together to enjoy it and watch the dogs work and have that experience. So I would 100% agree with that.
Yeah. Well, I had no idea that you had that kind of a upland excellent adventure in your history, but that sounds like a phenomenal trip. That is a really cool experience that you can remember for quite a long time.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that anyone that can just drop everything and, you know, grab a camper and go away for a couple months, I would highly recommend that they try it.
Joel, I want to talk about shotguns now. And it's taken us a little while, but we haven't even really dove into Griffin and Howe and your work there and how that ties together with shotguns. And I'm trying to figure out the best way to dive into this, because if anybody listening to this thinks your voice sounds familiar, they may be recognizing it from a recently released Project Upland film titled Legacy, which was about essentially about AYA shotguns and rough grouse and woodcock hunting. And that was done at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp while you and I were there a couple of falls ago. That's where I met you. And along with that film is, you know, it's more than just a film about rough grouse and woodcock hunting. You actually got to take a trip to the AYA factory in Spain. So I want you to talk about that, but I guess let's set the stage a little bit with Griffin and Howe. Talk about what you do for Griffin and Howe. And actually, I'm even further ahead of myself than I want to be. What is Griffin and Howe for those that don't know?
Certainly. So, you have to start with a little bit of history, I suppose.
Yes,
so
let's do it.
For the listeners that don't know Griffin and Howe, Griffin and Howe was founded in 1923 in New York City. Essentially, one of the oldest gun makers and gunsmiths in the country. Started out sporterizing military rifles. So they would take Mausers and Springfields, which were essentially, you know, World War One bolt action rifles, and turn them into sporter rifles for, you know, GIs coming back from the wars, that they could take them hunting and use them, you know, in everyday situations. Fast forward a number of years, you know, Griffin and Howe was initially at Abercrombie and Fitch. They were, for those of you who don't know, Abercrombie and Fitch was an outfitter and a safari outfitter in New York City, importer of fine firearms, steeped in history with English gun makers and all the rest, and eventually progressed out of New York City to Bernardsville, New Jersey, and then from Bernardsville, New Jersey to our home location now in Andover, New Jersey. So we are now located on the grounds of Hudson Farm. So Griffin and Howe at Hudson Farm. We have kind of two sides to the organization. So Griffin and Howe is, we are gunsmiths and gun makers, but we are also at our new location at Hudson Farm. We are also a shooting school, shooting academy. We offer shotgun lessons, rifle lessons, archery, fly fishing. There's a showroom and a pro shop there. We do firearms consignments, purchase collections. I mean, essentially, it's a overarching kind of view of it. But the goal is to become and to kind of recreate that classic idea of being an outfitter. We want folks to come to Griffin and Howe to have the experience soup to nuts. We can give you everything you need. So if you've never pursued anything in the out of doors before, we can not only give you the apparel and the gear, we can get you lessons. And then even as much as we've just started doing Griffin and Howe Outdoor Adventures, all the way through to advising you on where to go. And that's kind of that holistic picture that we're trying to paint right now, is that we want to be able to give you the holistic picture of, if you come into us, we're going to try and take care of you from beginning to end. And I think that's kind of a unique thing. And it's something that we did in the past. So Griffin and Howe, you know, when we were at Abercrombie and Fitch, that's what we did. We were outfitters, and outfitters in every sense of the word. But so our core of operations right now, we're gunsmiths and gun manufacturers. And we are, you know, we do consignments and firearm sales. We probably have 700 to 800 firearms on the floor at any given time. And then again, a big part of what we do is we have NSCA instructors up through level 3. Some very, very fine instructors in Kevin Sturck and Grace Callahan, some folks that are there that are, have shot and are shooting currently professionally. And it's a mecca essentially for the shooting sports. And we want to try to expand that as much as we can. So that's kind of the, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it sounds like a place I'd like to visit, Joel.
You are welcome anytime. Open arms. Come, please come visit. It'll give me an excuse to get out of the office for a little bit and go shoot for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that. No, that is more, I'm sure you probably told me that late one night at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp, but that's, it's more, almost more like all encompassing than I recall. And certainly I'm interested in the shotgun aspect, and I often look at the Griffin and Howe website and look at your used shotgun inventory, because that's something I do in my spare time when I have a minute or two, because I know that you work there, and I know if I see anything interesting, I can give you a call.
Yep. Well, we, like I said, we, Primarily deal in classic sporting firearms. So, and we are also agents for some of the bigger companies, you know, over the pond. So, we have just recently partnered very closely with, James Purdy and Sons.
Okay.
And, Royal Berkshire is their, sporting agency and shooting school in England. So we actually work closely with them, but we've worked with Boss and Holland and AYA, and we work with a lot of different makers over the years and have contacts and do import export on the grounds. We do, you know, all the basics, gun fittings and gun repairs and stock alterations. I mean, we are and try to be a full service operation. Actually, the shooting grounds that we have in New Jersey is 4,000 acres. So we actually do have quite a piece of property there, 30 stations of sporting clays, trap range, 5 stand. We just put in a 15-station 3D archery course. We have a section of a river that we've worked with Trout Unlimited to make it to like the ideal trout fishing stream. So we work with Ducks Unlimited on our ponds and swamps. Everything's managed. I mean, this is a, when I say it's a facility, it is a, in every facet of the word, a facility that we try to do the whole works.
Let me ask you this. Does Griffin and Howe, do they make guns or did they make guns at one time?
So we have made, it's, so the name has so such a long history that when you look at guns that are marked Griffin and Howe, there's a lot of different iterations of that. So when you pick up a Griffin and Howe, it might be a Greifelt, an old shotgun of German make, or we were importers with von Lingerke and Dietmold, you know, Frankhots and Belgian guns. So there's a lot of different guns that, that have come in with the Griffin and Howe name. I actually own a Belgian Browning over and under that is, you know, has on the barrel made exclusively for Griffin and Howe.
Okay.
Over the course of time, there's been a lot of times where we've put our names on guns. We have always made the Sporter rifles. So the Griffin and Howe marks rifles, which are primarily Winchesters, Mausers, and Springfields. Those are guns that we basically took the action of, stripped everything off of, restocked, rebarreled, metalwork, woodwork, the whole picture put back together and made it to beautiful sporting rifles. So those rifles are the works of art that Griffin and Howe has been putting out. I think we're somewhere in the serial number range of 2,800. So over the last 100 years, there's only been about 2,800 of those produced. But as far as shotguns are concerned, we've worked with a number of different outmakers, both doing work in our shop and work outside to create a variety of different shotguns.
Sure.
And it's so, I mean, we have worked with Spanish makers in the past, and certainly the folks that are in the know that know shotguns. We have Griffin and Howe, our Griffin and Howe round body guns, our game guns, which are our side-by-side game guns, and those most recently are AYA shotguns.
Oh, they are.
So
okay.
So that's something that, you know, we've worked with them for years. And, you know, again, like I said, if you do some research, you can find out who the makers are. And that's certainly not a secret.
Right.
We don't have the ability to do the castings and the barrel forgings and that kind of stuff in our facility in New Jersey. So we have to rely on outworkers. And then, again, we do as much finished work as we possibly can to kind of give the guns our own touch.
Sure. So would the round body Griffin and Howe game gun, would that be essentially like on a side lock number 2 platform from AYA?
More or less. Yeah. Okay. So there you're looking at an AYA platform and then custom engraving and
sure.
upgraded wood and, you know, variety of different things that we kind of request from them. You know, we do things with stock dimensions. We request specific dimensions and different pieces of it that kind of make it our own. But in so many words, it is an AYA at this point in time.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. That's definitely not an uncommon thing for somebody to do. But my question was coming from when I'm perusing Guns International, looking at shotguns and stuff. It's not uncommon to come across a gun that is labeled, or it's either labeled as Griffin Howe, or you can see it says Griffin and Howe on it. So I was kind of curious how some of those guns came to be. And it sounds like various ways that would have happened.
Sure. I mean, again, there's 100 years of history. So
right.
When you find a gun that has Griffin and Howe on it, there's going to be some history there. Actually, one of the coolest things that I've gotten to do since starting with Griffin and Howe was get into the archives a little bit. And we have the old archival books in our warehouse in a, you know, controlled facility where I can go back to the 1900s and look at the handwritten records of guns that came in to VLND, VLNA, like these early importers into the States. And I can look back in the records and there's handwritten notes about the guns, their dimensions and who they went to. So that's one of the best things about Griffin now is that we have that history and that legacy. And I can, like I said, I can still go and get the original books from New York City and look up when a rifle was produced, when a shotgun might have been imported, and, you know, get people the history on these firearms, which just it gives them some intrinsic value that, you know, and maybe a more modern firearm doesn't quite possess, doesn't have that mystique and that romance that some of these older guns have.
Yeah, the line of Griffin and Howe is unbroken, if you will, and that's unique, I would say, in this day and age to maintain that history. And now that it's spanned long enough where now that adds value and it adds sort of the mystique to a particular gun or a company in this case that, you know, you guys can refer back to those books, those orders. That's for people that like history, which is not an uncommon thing for people that like vintage shotguns. You know, they usually like history.
Sure, of course.
What about you, Joel? Were you a shotgun nut before you started working there, or did Griffin and Howe just sort of amplify what was inside you?
Yeah, I would say that Griffin and Howe was a magnifier,
sure,
more than anything. So if you get into bird hunting, you're eventually going to work on a shotgun because invariably something breaks, something malfunctions. And being a longtime bird hunter and a longtime shotgun shooter, you know, I had cleaned guns and done that type of thing before, but I'd never really gotten into gunsmithing. And actually, again, the influence of my father, he retired from the state and started essentially working as a gunsmith on the side in his basement on his own firearms. He would, you know, purchase a gun and fix it up for himself or work on different things. And that propelled me into learning more about the intricacies of firearms. I can't exactly say when it was, but somewhere along the way, I decided that I wanted to get a side-by-side shotgun. And I don't know why. I couldn't pick the exact moment, but I can remember at a gun show, I purchased the cheap side-by-side shotgun, but it was a Savage Stevens, but it was a 20 gauge and it was a side-by-side, and that meant something to me. And I think that was my first step into kind of really getting into gunsmithing, shotguns, and in particular side-by-side shotguns. My time at Griffin and Howe has only kind of amplified that and, you know, thrown me down the rabbit hole, so to speak. You know, I went from owning one side-by-side to a whole collection of them, and I certainly am not stopping anytime soon.
And you still have that Savage Stevens, don't you?
I did. I actually very recently, as a thank you gift to my friend in Alaska, I actually sent that gun along to him.
No way. That's cool.
Yeah, it was my first side-by-side, and he has a son, and I felt like it should travel the world. You know, I felt like it should also be somebody else's first side-by-side, and my friend also has never owned a side-by-side, and it just felt appropriate. So that gun is off to grand adventures right now, hopefully.
Paying it forward, man. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's just it. I think, again, the whole thing that we love, the mystique and all that, it has to start. There has to be a spark. And at least for me, you know, being able to gift that firearm to my friend and say, here, you know, have a side-by-side, try it out. It might be tough at first. There's two triggers. It's going to take a while. And it's just fun for me because I know what he's going to go through. I know how frustrated he's going to be, but I love it because when he kills something with it, I know that he's going to call me and let me know.
Yeah. That's something you talked about in the Project Upland Film Legacy a little bit, in sort of making the, I believe you called it, a philosophical shift. And I related to that because I went through the same thing in that, you know, my first shotgun was a Remington 870 pump 20 gauge, like a lot of people probably listening to this, you know, it's not uncommon. And I I always liked guns. I liked guns. I never, you know, the old, it's almost cliche, people say I consider them a tool, and that's fine. I always really liked shotguns and had an interest in them. My interest was limited and I didn't dive deep on side-by-sides or over-unders or anything like that. But I shot a pump shotgun for quite a while. And then eventually, it's kind of like similar to your story. I don't know what it was inside me that sparked, but it was, hey, I want a break action gun. And for me, that was an over-under, and it was a Satori, a Browning Satori was something that I had, because I had a Browning pump and I always liked Browning guns, so I wanted a Browning Satori. And long story short, I've talked about those elements before, but I sort of made that philosophical shift where I shot a pump and then an over-under, and now I really like side-by-side shotguns. And it was a progression for me, and that progression isn't necessarily going to play out the same way or look the same way for everybody else, but that is kind of how it happens. And that's what you talked about in that film, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is to be, you know, again, to pull my own skeletons out of the closet. My first gun was a 20 gauge 870, just the same. And I still have, you know, several 870s that have a home in my gun room. So I think that, again, I think that it's a shift. It's just a kind of respect for the past, and it just makes it more interesting and more entertaining for me. And, you know, I certainly am not going to be that guy that says you have to shoot a certain gun to be out in the uplands, because for the first, probably 10 or more years that I shot birds, it was with a pump or an auto. So, you know, I'm the last person that's going to tell somebody what they need to shoot out there. But, you know, I think the bigger thing, like you said, is everybody arrives where they're going to be for whatever reasons. And I think that the camaraderie and, again, the elements that you find in the camaraderie and the chasing of those birds and the fact that we're all upland hunters is what binds us together, not what necessarily what firearm we decide to shoot. So,
yeah, well, I definitely want to ask you a little bit. We're getting a little bit closer to time, and I don't want to keep you too much longer. We can always have you back on, Joel, because I know where you work, so we could do that again. But I do want to ask you, you know, as someone that's gone through this progression and you now have this affinity for shotguns, and you've taken it a step further, you've learned, you know, some tools and skills of the trade, learning how to work on them a little bit. You did have the opportunity to cross the pond, head over to Ibar and go to the AYA factory. What was that like? Talk a little bit about your experience over there.
Yeah. So in the process of the filming and meeting you guys and talking with AYA, so Griffin and Howe has talked with AYA and been in business with AYA for a long time. And it just so happened that it was a prime opportunity to go visit and strengthen that connection with AYA. And let me tell you, the trip over there was an eye opener. So I'm used to our facility and the way we work at Griffin and Howe. We have an almost 6,000 square foot gunsmithing facility. We have a lot of machinery. To be completely honest, the AYA factory was considerably larger, much more floor space, but in the same vein, far more industrial. So when we got there, it was much more like a machine shop, much more like a production kind of manufacturing facility. But the thing that kind of strikes you when you go there is that although there's machinery and big things going on, there's a lot of people there and they're doing a lot of handwork. And I think that that was one of the things that definitely hit me about it, is there's still a collection of guys on benches doing the handwork to make those firearms. And the skills that those gentlemen possess, gentlewomen that are there, I mean, that they possess is phenomenal. And you watch them do their work and they are certainly, most certainly skilled craftsmen. So, man, flew in and crazy ride through the mountains. It looks like the Northwest. It's very green and damp. It's not like you would imagine Spain would be in Ibar. A lot of industry in the north of Spain there, a lot of factories and things. But again, in this extremely steep kind of rural setting, and got to see the factory, got to watch the guys work. And, you know, there were things that I had never seen before. I had never seen folks joining barrels, you know, taking the two halves of the barrels all the way back to the block and putting them together and wiring them in and, you know, laying the ribs, putting them through the oven, soldering them together, barrel drills. And I mean, again, it was quite an experience to see all that. They also have a lot of modern machinery there. So they do have CNC machinery that deals with the actions and the cutting. So they're, again, it's a good combination of the new and the old. So they're really trying to increase production and be able to make a quality product while still having, you know, again, there's men and women there hand engraved, you know, they're on engraving easels and hand engraving. You can look through the window and watch them engrave the shotguns. And it's very hard. Again, it's hard for me to kind of put it into a few words. It would take a whole nother podcast to to go through the whole experience.
Right.
But, Alex and the folks at AYA were extremely welcoming to us, and I will always be thankful that they kind of gave us a window into what it is they do over there. An amazing process for sure.
Yeah. Sounded like a really cool trip, and folks can get a little bit of a sneak peek from it if they watch the legacy film. I'll throw a link to that in the show notes. Two more questions for you before I let you go, Joel. One of them, I guess they're both related, but I'm curious, as somebody that now has a number of guns in his collection, and more importantly, somebody that gets to see, handle, and shoot a lot of different shotguns working at Griffin and Howe. Number one is, do you have a favorite gun in your collection right now? If you're going to go bird hunting, is there one that you pick up more than the others?
Oh boy, that's a dangerous question to ask. So short answer is yes, but it's not my favorite right now because I have to do some work to it to figure out what's going on. But I have a 20 gauge Fox that I've been shooting this season, and I dearly love it.
Sterlingworth?
It's okay. A Fox Sterlingworth. And someone put a leather covered recoil pad on it, so it's got added length. So for my monkey arms, it actually is long enough that I can shoot it. But I actually was experiencing some intermittent primer strikes. So I was actually getting some no fires. I was getting dented primers, but no fires. So that's kind of on the shelf right now. But for sure, it's a new to me gun. This is the first season I hunted with this 20 gauge Sterlingworth. And I have to say, I've been leaning on it quite heavily this year.
Okay.
And taking it out quite a bit. I also have a penchant for 16 gauge guns, and I have a 16 gauge JP Sauer Krupp steel hammer side by side that I take out once a season and then put back on the rack. So that's also a personal favorite, but again, this year that 20 gauge has been out quite a bit.
The 16 gauge JP Sauer is a gun that I'm rather fond of, and that's probably because a couple people I know have them, and I've been able to put my hands on a couple of JP Sauers, and they are, for what they are, I would say that they're definitely undervalued, you know.
Oh man,
most often
you want to talk about a value in the gun market right now,
right?
This will be my one tip to folks out there who are looking for guns. I know that I know the legend and the lore of the Fox, the LC,
yep,
and the Parker. If you want to get bang for your buck right now, it's in Continental guns.
Yeah.
It's in your Belgian guns, your German guns, your guild guns. Man, you can get a firearm that has side clips, a greener crossbow, triple lockup, ejectors, cocking indicators, the whole works.
Yeah.
I mean, you name it, and it's a fraction of the cost of some of these other firearms. So for any of you aspiring side-by-side folks out there, do not overlook the Sauers, the Frankhots, the Belgian guild guns, the German guild guns. I mean, there are some really good guns out there that I think a lot of folks tend to overlook because they're not a named side-by-side.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's a great tip. And that, yeah, the JP Sauers, they do it for me. They're a really, really good gun, and they have kind of all of the, they really check all the boxes if you find the right one. But my other question for you, do you have your eyes on anything? Is there anything that you're out there looking for? I mean, you know, a good bird hunter is kind of always looking for his or her next gun, but is there anything, it doesn't always take a physical form. You know, sometimes it's just it's still a twinkle in that person's eye, but does your next gun, do you know what it looks like?
Well, I have, so there's always the dream, right?
There's always
the dream gun that you're looking for that may come in sometimes. So if anybody out there wants to separate with a 20 gauge Parker,
you know, graded
20 gauge Parker
for dirt cheap,
for dirt cheap with good dimensions, I'm certainly interested. I think, this is going to be one of those things. I think the main thing that people need to focus on when looking at a shotgun is the fit. And I can't stress enough getting a gun fit, getting your measurements. And, you know, I know most folks out there know about the hip uplander, but there was a great little meme about, you know, forget the dimensions, I'll just shoot it anyway.
Yeah.
Kind of
yep.
idea. So my thing is, please don't forget the dimensions. It's great to own old shotguns. It's great to pursue it all and to look at that. But I think that gun fit and gun dimensions are so important. And I think that one of the bigger things that people miss when they're looking for a gun is that it has to fit you, or you're just never going to have the experience that you deserve out of it. You're better off, you know, you're better off. So if I had a 20 gauge Parker that came in that was 12 and a half inches length of pull, I wouldn't buy it because it's not going to fit me. And I don't want to put a big chunk of wood on the end of it to make it fit me. And that's the thing that you have to be able to walk away from, is to say, I'm not going to have a negative experience with a gun that doesn't work for me. I'm going to hold out for the gun that does work for me. And I think that's an important factor in knowing, hey, look, I'm going to look for something that actually works for what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, that's a great point, Joel. Shout out to the Hip Uplander. I wonder if that's the first podcast reference for the Hip Uplander. I hope he's listening.
I hope I'm not that guy that pulls that in, but I kind of had to, you know.
No, he's made quite a splash. It's or I should say he or she, because, you know, obviously the mystery behind it all. But
yeah,
shout out to the Hip Uplander. I definitely chuckled when they did the Gun Dimensions one, because that is personal to me, because I went through that myself. And I couldn't agree with you more, Joel. I don't want to say I learned it the hard way, because I kind of, you know, I just sort of did it myself. I wound up with a 16 gauge Fox Sterlingworth, and I shot a little bit, and, you know, it took a little while, but I realized that really it hit home this year, because this year I shot a gun that is a much better fit for me based on recommendations by a gun fitter. And that proved to be true over and over and over again, actually carrying it and shooting it in the grouse woods. And when I was hunting, I shot it way better than I shoot my Fox Sterlingworth. And so, and that was something that, you know, Greg Elliott of Dogs and Doubles, he told me right away, you know, he mentioned fit, but I was new to the side-by-side game. I was swept away a little bit by the Americana and the Fox mm-hmm. Sterlingworth. And that doesn't lessen my interest in those guns at all. But having a gun that I know fits me better and I can shoot well makes me feel a lot better than, again, trying to force a square peg into a round hole, taking a vintage American gun out in the woods and getting frustrated with it. Now, I know guys and girls, and I'm sure you do too, Joel, that they're well aware of sort of the fit issues of a certain gun, and they can kind of pick up different guns and they can adapt themselves to various guns and shoot them well. I'm not one of those people. I don't know that I ever will be, but as long as you know that, the worst case scenario is somebody that doesn't really understand fit or gun dimensions, and then they take that gun out in the field and they have a bad experience with it.
Yeah. Well, so the best thing I can say to people, and I've had the opportunity to shoot quite a few guns over my course of time with Griffin and Howe. So I started at Griffin and Howe as the shop coordinator, shop manager for the gunsmith shop. And I did that for about 2 years. And over the course of that time, I was the person who test fired all the repairs that came through the shop. And in that position, shooting every gun that came through the shop gave me a really unique perspective on what gun fit actually means. And you, there's no better way to experience that than picking up a left-handed gun, a left-handed sporting clays gun, and trying to shoot it as a right-handed guy. I mean, I cannot urge people more to take a few shots with your buddy's gun that has different dimensions when you're shooting, to experience what it feels like to just have an idea or a concept of how important that actually is.
Sure.
And again, switching from gun to gun, from my experience and taking guns out and shooting, say, 6 completely different guns, it does make you a better shooter, because just like you're saying, you pick up on the differences in the guns and you can compensate. But I think for most folks, you don't want to have to compensate. And I think that the reality is taking the compensation out is going to make your life so much better when you get out into the woods and you have that one opportunity that you've worked for. And it's the last year that there's a grouse season in New Jersey, and the last grouse you're ever going to flush gets up. You want to make sure that gun fits. And taking any of the guesswork out is something that you can do ahead of time with a gun fit and with a properly fitting shotgun.
Absolutely. Yeah. Compensating for gun fit is one thing on the clays course, but in the woods or the field when it's,
you can't do it.
Exactly. Yeah. And why would you want to? Joel, this has been a lot of fun. I think, definitely I'm excited to have you back on. Maybe we could dive a little bit deeper into shotgun buying and selling. That was a topic that we didn't get to go as deep on as I wanted to, but there's no reason we couldn't have you back on. Thank you for taking the time to speak to me and the Project Upland community. appreciate it, man. And I'll look forward to keeping in touch with you, and hopefully our paths will cross. Where can people go to find out more about Griffin and Howe?
Yeah, so Griffin and Howe website. So it's griffinhowe.com. So GRIFFINHOWE.com. Check us out online. You're certainly welcome to peruse our gun collection there. We're located in Andover, New Jersey. So if anybody's ever in the New York City area, we're a close jump, about 50 minutes from New York City. So anyone who's interested, please look me up, look us up. You know, you're welcome on the grounds. I'll give you a tour anytime. You can come see the gunsmithing shop and the facility. I'd love to have you and kind of show you our world. It'd be my pleasure.
Absolutely. Yeah. I encourage people to go on Griffin and Howe website, check out the used gun inventory. And if they see something they like, give you a call, Joel.
Yeah, please do. Like I said, we always have things coming through. So it's definitely a good place to check out.
Good deal, man. Well, I appreciate it. I wish you a very Merry Christmas as we're very close to the holidays here, man. Take care and we'll be in touch. All right.
Yeah, Nick, thanks again for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure, Joel. Take care.
All right.
Yeah. See ya. Thank you for listening to the Project Upland podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. The podcast is also brought to you by Pine Ridge Grouse Camp, Dogs or Collars, Yukonuba Premium Performance Dog Food, Gumleaf USA, Gordian Sons Outfitters, and Dakota 283 Kennels. Don't forget to leave us a rating, leave us a review, subscribe to the podcast, and share the podcast post. You could be next week's winner of the Project Upland podcast giveaway. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.